chapter 21, verse 1 of John, afterward Jesus appeared again to his disciples. It's literally, in the original language, again he revealed himself. And the NIV waters the Greek word down, but the word speaks of more than just physical visibility. It wasn't just that they saw him with their eyeballs again, the third time, but it has to do with spiritual perception. In fact, it's almost always translated in the King James Bible, the word manifested, which speaks of revealing things about yourself, about your character, revealing how you feel about somebody, revealing your power. And so it's interesting that John, thinking back on this under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, is saying, you know, Jesus showed us something about himself, the way he is, in this incident. And the reason I wanted to talk about this week, I don't know when we'll get to John again. We do have John uploaded to the website, so, I mean, you can listen to this. But it's an important thing to understand in the very end of Matthew's gospel. Matthew doesn't mention this, and the other guys don't mention it either. And apparently the Holy Spirit thought it was important that we understand how Jesus deals with people who fail. I need to hear this. Some of you need to hear this. Some people listening online need to hear this. How does Jesus deal with people who make promises and then don't keep them? And for some people, the answer may really surprise you. It may actually set you free. That's my prayer. I was all prepared to do the Great Commission, and as I was reading through this passage, I felt like the Lord said, you know, you don't know who's going to be listening. Talk about this. I want people to know, and there are some that really need to know this. I was raised in a very legalistic church till I came to Calvary Chapel. And every message was everything was about you and your devotion and your performance and how you measure up. And your view of God in that kind of a performance-based system is like God's got the clipboard. He's got the stats of everybody else, your age or everybody else with your job or every other mom or every other dad or every other pastor. And he's got a stopwatch and he's timing you to see if you can run the 50-yard dash as fast as Billy Graham or somebody else. And it's all about you measuring up. Sometimes God is easier to please than we are ourselves. Sometimes we have an idea what the perfect mom is. We have an idea what the perfect dad is. I'm all the time getting discouraged by just looking at my first church, which was huge. And it's impossible to not make comparisons unless you're looking at the orders that you have from your master today. What's my master telling me to do today? Oh, but, you know, I've blown it so many times. No, that's what the cross is for. It's to cover those failures. If you're doing what he told you to do today, that's all that he expects. But it's way better than that. He's in a posture, and we see that in both of these incidents. Actually, we saw it last week as well. He's in a posture where he's on your side. He wants you to grow. He wants you to be fruitful. He wants you to shake loose from your family history. He wants you to shake loose from pattern of failures in your life. He is on your side for you to grow. And a lot of people don't know that. They think he's just an observer with the stopwatch and the clipboard, and he's grading you. But see, what Jesus just did was he died for the failures of the whole world. He paid the price. That means you don't have to. There may be consequences of your failures that he doesn't take away, but mostly that has to do with people, doesn't it? I mean, God may forgive, but people don't. I've got guys that are in my face after 28 years of not even of stuff I did, but of stuff they thought I did 20 years ago, 28 years ago. They still view me a certain way. And of course, then there's the stuff that I did do that nobody knows about that, you know, you carry with you. So these are wonderful things. And John said, you know, Jesus showed us some stuff. And then he talks about two specific incidences. They happened on that trip to Galilee that Jesus made where he met his followers on safe ground because they were terrified to be in Jerusalem. We're not going to look at all the Gospels, but I did want to talk about these two incidents. So, seven of them, did I count right? Simon Peter, Thomas, Nathaniel, James and John, and two others. That's seven, yeah. So seven of them, not all 11 of them. Maybe some of them, you know, got seasick. I didn't want to go. Maybe some of them just, who wants to go fishing? And some of the guys said, okay, Peter, if you're going to go, we'll go. I read several commentators that said because this happened after Jesus gave them the Great Commission, go into all the world and preach the gospel, that this was an example of Peter disobeying. Peter, what are you doing? Fishing. He told you to go into all the world and preach the gospel. Well, next week we'll look at the unfortunate translation of the word go is not an imperative verb. It's a participle. It's as you are going or going into all the world. And then the imperative, preach the gospel, Mark says, and Matthew says, make disciples. So it's not, I'm sending you out this minute. It's as you're living the rest of your life in this world, this is what I want you to do. I want you to just glow in the darkness. I want you to share the gospel everywhere that you live your life and help people to be a follower of Jesus. We'll look at that next week. That's just a little hors d'oeuvre. So the seven of them go out fishing, and this one commentator says Peter's disobeying here. But the Greek word for going fishing is the word for an excursion, not the word for a career. So Peter just didn't know what to do, so he said, that's it, I'm going fishing. It's kind of pathetic in a way, but you go to what's familiar. For me, it's woodworking. If I need to process things, and in Maine, you know, some time of the year I can go down to my boat and I can just get away from land and I can think clearly, or I can just go putz around in my workshop or piddle around on the boat. Something to work with my hands so that I don't self-destruct emotionally. And so with Peter, it's fishing. I know actually several people like this. There's something about the mechanics of something you've done so much that takes care of one part of your brain, and you can be occupied with that. And I cannot imagine Peter being able to shake loose his failure. At the absolute critical moment, there's this person that you love. There's this person that's changed your whole life. You make bold promises to them. And then right at the most important point, you fail. And you don't just fail invisibly. You fail with lights, camera, action, and background music. I mean, you fail big time. I can't imagine Peter could get that out of his mind. Any of you remember that Don Francisco song from years ago called He's Alive? Boy, that powerful lyrics. But there's this, it's a dialogue that Peter is going through when he realizes he's failed. Jesus told him he was going to fail. He said he wasn't going to fail. He failed worse than any of the other guys. And there's this poignant lyric. It's when Peter is singing in this lyric and he's saying, you know, the other guys say that he's alive. Well, I hope that that's true. But you know what? Even if he is alive, it won't be the same. Peter, filled with hopelessness and his failure. Yeah, okay, Jesus is alive. Yeah, that doesn't change what I did. It doesn't change that I can't be trusted. Oh, man, that's such a good place to be. I have seen in many people's lives that God will engineer failures We think we're strong. He knows we're not. So he will say, okay, go for it. Do it yourself. Psychologists tell us that failure is part of education. It's certainly not something that modern 21st century American Christianity values very highly. It's all about, in our culture, it's all about being a person that does it right and is victorious. But in God's program, Peter needed to fail. Peter needed to know that he didn't have what it takes. He needed Jesus. And never underestimate the value of failure. If what follows it is that you learn to depend on Jesus. A couple of rabbit trails about this. They fished all night long because Peter didn't know what else to do, but you know what? He did the thing that he'd done how many thousands of times, and it didn't work. Which leads me to rabbit trail number one. They caught nothing. I said earlier, because I couldn't resist on the way through this as we were reading it, that I believe this was providence. When Jesus shows up on the shore, he knows they haven't caught anything. I think he arranged it that they wouldn't catch anything because he needed to make a point. He asks them to do something completely illogical. He asks them to repeat something that they'd already done hundreds of times and it didn't work. This is the way the conversation has worked with me in my life. When I've done something to the best of my ability and it's not worked, when I tried as hard as I could and I fell flat on my lips, and I'm so frustrated, and I'm thinking, I can't do this. And then Jesus comes along, and he asks me to do the very same thing. Maybe tweaks it just a little bit. In this case, it was even more illogical. Throw your net on the other side of the boat. And can you see these guys looking at each other and rolling their eyes and saying, carpenters? You know, what do they know? But see, it wasn't about logic. It was about obedience. Here's the way it works with me. I've done it 100 times as best I knew how. It's not worked. And Jesus tells me to do it again. And I said, but I've done it 100 times and it didn't work. And he says, yeah, but this time I'm telling you to do it. And that changes everything. Oh, you don't know how many marriage counseling classes we went to, or you don't know how many times I've tried this job, or you don't know how many times I've tried to lose weight, or blah, blah, fill in the blank. And it's about you and your effort and your planning. And sometimes God allows that to fail. And when we're desperate, and then we decide to ask him what he wants, it's shocking how many times he'll send you right back to that very place, that very person, that very thing that you failed at. Only now he's saying, now I'm telling you to do it. You see the difference? Well, I would have to say a lot of American Christians don't see the difference because we don't understand what it means to follow. Oswald Chambers says we can't call ourselves followers of Jesus if we're taking the initiative. That's un-American, isn't it? American Christianity is all about initiative. Get out there. Live your dreams, baby. Lord, take up your cross, follow me. And, you know, and then we go and it's all about us fulfilling our dreams. And God says, you know, we don't do it that way in my kingdom. Elizabeth Elliot said it this way. She said, God always calls us to do things that are impossible to do without his help. I don't know about you, but I feel guilty when I need God's help. But God says, no, that's the way it's supposed to be. So here's the first test. Well, for Peter, it's the second test. The first test was, okay, Peter, you going to take a bullet for me, buddy? Peter, you going to be the one that stands in there? And Peter just blew it royally. So now he's got his backup plan. His backup plan is, well, you know what? I can always fish. And the Lord says, okay, you don't need me. Remember one of the last conversations Jesus had with these guys? He said, I'm a vine, you're branches. if you are cut off from my life, you can do nothing. Well, heck, that's practically not true, is it? I can teach Bible studies without Jesus. I mean, thousands of pastors do it every Sunday. I have all kinds of things I can do without Jesus. I don't even have to consult him. I'll just go do them. But see, what he was telling them in that speech in John 15 was, he said, from my perspective, if you're doing this without me, it's nothing. It's a waste of energy. So it's just, isn't it interesting? And I know some of you have been in this place. Maybe you're in this place right now. I know I am. You know, I have to be careful what I say. You're just working as hard as you can, and it doesn't look like it's working. And what he's trying to say is, no, you can't do this without me. You are going to need me completely. And so often the first step to victory, please hear me, is failure. And I will have to tell you that for some people, it's going to have to be a bigger failure than with others. People who've always been successful at what they've done, people who are entrepreneurial and creative and energetic and have lots of drive, those people are going to have to probably bust their chops, falling on their lips before they come to an end of self-reliance. Is God being a bully? Oh, no, just the opposite. He's protecting us. Because when it really comes down to it, I don't have what it takes to do what God is asking me to do. So I need to fail. So often the first step to victory is failure. I had a lady in my first church. She's in heaven now. She was one of these people that could have had her own TV show. She was young. She was attractive. She was totally in fabulous shape. She taught all kinds of exercise classes. She absolutely ate impeccably when it came to eating the right kinds of things. She knew all kinds of things about her physiology, what kinds of foods to combine. And she was hired by the state that I lived in as a counselor's psychologist, meaning that she went into all of the schools and told all of the counselors how to do their jobs. So she's telling these people who are in charge of children's problems how to help children solve their problems. And her whole life came crashing down right before she met Jesus. She found out she had kidney cancer, and she had an indeterminate short period of time to live, even with treatment. Her kids also were hooked on drugs. So everything that she was the poster child for her own philosophy, she was the example of, follow me, I know where I'm going, and her whole life crashed. When her whole life crashed because she put all of her weight on that philosophy, if you just believe in yourself, you can do it, she didn't have any place to turn. And a high school kid who went to my church said, well, you need Jesus. And she said, no, that can't be it. Well, she didn't know anything about Jesus. She just had this picture that a lot of people have in their mind. Oh, you know, it's that religion stuff. I don't need that religion stuff. No, she said, no, you need Jesus. You need the real Jesus. You need to know him. You need his power in your life. And she came to our church. She was blown away to see, you know, 200 high school and college age kids and several hundred young people and few old ladies and old guys. It kind of blew her away. It was so not what she was expecting. And the first time that I gave an invitation, she gave her life to Jesus. And she looked like a person when I met her that was dying in every way, crushed with failure in raising her kids, crushed because she saw them making really bad choices and it broke her heart, and crushed because all of her, she didn't know what to do. She had no plan B for how to take care of her body. So she dove for that life preserver in that pure faith way where somebody's not coming to Jesus and handing them their resume and saying, here, Jesus, if you like me on your team, this is everybody really thinks I'm good at these things. No, she was desperate. and Jesus came into her life, and he just filled her up. And my memories of her, the last 2 years of her life, I got to be her pastor, which was just a wonderful thing, because she was one of the people that sat right in the front row and just glowed in the dark. She could not stop smiling. She was at every Bible study. She just wanted to make up for all this lost time. God used her life in a remarkable way. But what a difference it was to see a woman who had all the answers. It's just none of them worked. And then she did that illogical thing of giving her life to Jesus, and then she found life, real life. And she told me the last time I saw her was shortly before she died, and she was in the hospital. She grabbed me. She was squeezing as hard as she could. She wasn't real strong anymore, but she's squeezing. She says, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." And I said, "For what?" And she said, "For changing my life." And I said, "I didn't do anything." And she said, "You told me about Jesus." She said, "You helped me to know him." And she said, "I've lived more of my life in this last 2 years or so than I have when I had all the answers." I've got a lot of stories like that of people who had to fail before they would even ask for help. So this whole deal with the 153 fish doesn't look like a very big deal. But see, this is these guys doing what they were good at. This was these guys exercising their, if all else fails, this is what I'll do to take care of myself. Can I tell you what's going to happen if you have something like that in your head? It will get torched. It's a false god.